afternoon. I just very briefly will reintroduce Vanessa, and I wanted to share a fun fact with everybody about Vanessa. She mentioned earlier that her shoes were not appropriate for the weather today. Right? I think you said that.
Let's move on. Yeah.
Well, apparently she had on the right shoes a few years ago. She ran the Oklahoma City Marathon without any training, which is very impressive on its own. But she did share that at one point she was passed by a very senior nun, right? She did finish the marathon, but along the way, what she noticed was the nun had on a very long skirt, and the skirt said that the nun was powered by God and Geritol. So, with further ado, Ms. Springs.
Thank you.
True story. Okay, so one of the things we want to talk about that Bobby has asked me to kind of moderate for a little while, and I will tell you at some point I'm going to pass it off to him because my flight leaves at 5:15, and I am very anxious to get out of here before the roads start doing something different, because when it does this at home, I'm hunkered down in the house for like 5 days. So, panelists, thank you all for being here. What I've done is, in talking about lessons learned, I've got a question that I want to ask each of you. So we'll start, and if you will introduce yourself, and then after you introduce yourself, I'll ask you the question, and then you can respond to the audience. And then by that time, it'll be time for the questions, and Bobby can take over from there. So, sir?
So good afternoon. I'm Matt Prouty. I am the commander of the patrol division at the City Police Department in Rutland.
Okay. One of the questions I want to ask you is, from a law enforcement perspective, as it relates to calls for service and law enforcement's interacting with the drug culture, what type of changes have you seen come about from field services with regard to drug courts?
Well, I think the biggest change is that we've really put a big effort in the last couple of years into this education on how drugs affect the brain. And that whole neuroscience thing they talked about last year here at this very conference. And when you're trying to change hearts and minds in your community about moral failure or weakness and those type of things that are often associated with people that use, and you're trying to get this grassroots change in culture, you need to be speaking that language a lot with a lot of different people, and it's changed at the dining room table in the squad room. So when you're changing a police culture, those type of things have to be done on the street. Where we can do an on-the-spot correction of a citizen that says, well, that scumbag, whatever, I say, hey, hold on a minute. That's somebody's son, daughter, whatever the case may be. And I think that's been the biggest change, at least for us at the PD, and we've been going, you know, in Rutland, people are pretty familiar with our struggle, and our struggle maybe on the opiate side may predate some of the other communities in Vermont, but one of the things I'm very proud of Rutland for is not being scared to take this issue on head on, and for us to sit back and say maybe our approach hasn't been correct, and we need to reevaluate and educate ourselves, and that's been translating into the treatment court, and a big reason why we're on the team.
Awesome. And I would just speak to that to just kind of give you a feather in your hat. What the research has shown is that someone from law enforcement has a greater likelihood of coercing someone into treatment than a judge with an order from the bench. And it is exactly speaks to what you just shared with us about that day-to-day interaction with those individuals. So thank you for that, and thank you for what you're doing. We appreciate it. Ma'am?
Thank you. I'm Sarah Reed, and I am the public defender that sits on the Chittenden County Drug and Mental Health Court dockets.
Well, one of the big questions with defense attorneys in the defense bar is I have to act in the best interest of my client. And sometimes that contradicts with what goes on in a drug court setting. So from your perspective as a defense attorney, what message would you take, to the field as far as the defense bar is concerned with, the value that drug court adds to the relationship between you and your client?
Well, the way that I practice has really changed a lot because of my involvement in drug court. I'm hoping this is going to answer your question. First off, an outcome of it is that I've gotten a lot more involved with my clients in general. They are people, they are parents, they are children, they are people who have an illness. For those folks who have addiction. So one of the things that I do in addition to assessing their case for constitutional issues, I also get to know them as a person. What struggles do they have? Are they facing an addiction? And if the case is yes, I will make recommendations to go and see the Howard Center in Burlington. I will give them information on how to get there. I will bug them about whether or not they've gone. I say, I'm going to get up in your business, and I do. And then when we have statuses with the court, one of the really important and unique things about a treatment court is the relationship between the participant and the judge, and I try to recreate that as much as I can by asking my clients, can I brag about you to the judge? And I do, and I usually get teary and, you know, just tell the judge everything that they've been doing. And outcomes for my clients are better because the judges are seeing them as people who are striving to break out of the chains of addiction. The prosecutors get to know all about my client, and I follow them around and tell them their stories. And so it's changed a lot in the outcomes for all of my clients, not just the treatment court clients.
Okay, thank you for that. Sir, if you'll introduce yourself.
Good afternoon. My name is Keith Talon. I'm the district manager of the Rutland Probation and Parole Office.
Okay, probation, for those that don't necessarily understand it, they have a different perception of what probation is. And we know that there is a distinct difference between dealing with a person in drug court as opposed to the traditional probation and parole setting. So can you tell us, based on your training and experience, what you've seen that transition has created with the outcomes with the clients on probation?
Absolutely. It's a win-win for the Department of Corrections, obviously, to have an offender involved in the drug court. It gives them extra incentive. It gives them incentive to deal with whatever they're before the court for, whether it be a violation of probation or a new charge that we would file a violation for. It gives them another case manager to oversee their case. It's an open door to treatment that can be facilitated by the team in the community. It's an opportunity to see the client in a whole different light in terms of their individuality, their specific needs, as opposed to being generalized as we tend to do in corrections. And it's a real vehicle for hope for them that it is so much different than meeting with the probation officer weekly and talking about the things that are going on in their lives and having that client feel that they have to be accountable for everything that they do and that person really is not there to help them. There's a lot of myths that can be dispelled by having that person involved in the treatment court and having the probation officer intimately involved in that treatment team.
Okay. Thank you. Sir?
Yes, Joe Perella. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney in Vermont for 20 years. Thank you, Judge Tour, for hiring me.
Good job.
And I'm also part of Judge Crawford's drug court team with Clay and Jess from Evergreen that are here and in Rutland.
Awesome. So, with regard to prosecution of cases, one of the big things we hear is caseloads and docket management, and then, of course, recidivism. So, can you address these issues with your involvement in the drug court program? What do you see happening with caseloads, recidivism?
Well, it's a little early to tell long-term how effective our drug court is, but so far, so good. I think that one of the more, you can't go in expecting 100% success rate, and our drug court in Rutland is pre-sentence, pre-judgment, so the minimum benefit is at least a probationary sentence, and that's after a year in drug court of proving that you can be a contributing member to society. And we've had people pass with flying colors, and they otherwise would have served a jail term, and those graduates have walked the line and are doing great. So, but it's, we've only been operating less than 18 months, so it's a little bit early to tell, but there's no question it's I think at this point in time, you could, if you want to just analyze it quantitatively, economically, it makes sense given the cost of prison. In terms of caseload, our office prosecutes a wide range of drug dealers. We don't prosecute people for mere possession, but a charge may, felony charge may be downgraded to mere possession. So we have our bigger dealers, often gun-toting, violent, woman abusers, human trafficking, that are often out of state, Holyoke, Springfield, Hartford, Connecticut, Brooklyn, the Bronx, and I know those towns were mentioned earlier, but by one of the speakers, but we do prosecute people from there, but we also prosecute lower level drug dealer addicts that often have had many choices or many opportunities, I should say, to before they're prosecuted federally to straighten things out. And given how difficult, particularly opiate addiction, is, they haven't. And so I'm not sure that caseload has actually changed, but we are, at least in Rutland area, are funneling people to drug court to give them an opportunity to earn a probationary sentence, or in some cases, felony dismissals or misdemeanor options.
So definite incentive that's there. And one of the things that we heard, I just learned a new term that I'm going to steal and call my own, and that was boutique courts. I hadn't heard that one. What we've heard is that drug courts have been referred to as hug-a-thug or clapping court. So from true story. So from each one of your perspectives, what message would you like to take to the community, to your profession, about what drug court is really all about? We'll start with you, sir.
Well, I have a pretty hard group of people to convince.
You do.
But I think a lot of that is, you can kind of stack the deck a little bit in our business, and that is, it is important when you choose your treatment court officer that it is somebody that has experience in the drug market, credibility with the officers. You don't want the, well, I won't tell you that another term.
Okay. I hear you.
Okay. Okay. She knows
yeah,
what I'm
I know what you're about to say.
Because who delivers the message to that particular group, whether it's the police or your politicians, whatever, is almost as important as the message itself. So that's one thing that I've learned. And I've been fortunate to be part of the process. And even though I don't have to convince everyone about the benefits of treatment court, but all I need to do is find the success and then make sure that we celebrate it internally and bring attention to it, because the proof's in the pudding. Mm-hmm. And when you've had people that, and believe me, I would have lost a lot of money if I actually bet on some people that I thought would pass or fail. So I don't even weigh in anymore on that part. I let Rose and Steve and those guys fight that out. Because I've been wrong a lot. Point is that the people that you think, oh, there's no way they're going to make it, you don't know what happens in that environment on the clinical side, or if there's a co-occurring disorder, or maybe it's just the structure itself is what causes the success. So when we get those pieces where everybody goes, oh my God, I can't believe so-and-so, I would have never thought that would be success here. We have to make sure we're celebrating it internally. We're talking about it. We're talking about it often. And that's goes a long way with changing hearts and minds, because that's really what we're trying to do. Not just in the public, but in your police departments, in your state offices, in your, you know, because there's a lot of, we all carry some bias, every single one of you. If you think you don't, you're wrong, okay? And this is an easy profession to get callous, to get a little jaded and with cynicism. So you really need to get back to that superordinate goal of protect and serve, and that whole piece about you know, that human side to this, and that helps you do that.
All right, thank you. Ma'am?
Some of the complaints that I've heard from defense counsel about treatment courts is kind of how much the court is involved in their lives, how much oversight there is, length of time sometimes. And my answer is always the same. If we are getting the right target population, treatment court is your wildest dream for your client. I mean, obviously, I don't want to gloss over that we have duties as attorneys to, you know, look at the state's case to see whether or not they can make out their case. And you don't toss that part out. But, you know, I think it's you can't really argue with the fact that there's a good portion of the cases that we get where the evidence is pretty stacked against your client. And so if we are getting the right target population in treatment courts, which is high risk, high need, you really are getting a huge benefit for your clients. Not only are they getting to avoid likely jail time, in all of our cases, jail time, we're also it's a chance for them to really stop the cycle for their families. And that's been mentioned a lot. And that's something that's really important to me. Our clients were not created in a vacuum. And I feel very strongly as a defense attorney that I have a duty to not just assess the criminal case, but I really have a duty to assist my client to do better, to be better.
Okay. Sir?
I think, you know, I worked 27 years in institutions, and it's very easy when you're in the institution and to not see success and to become cynical about the possibility of success. So I think too often correctional decision-making and our efforts are weighed too heavily on the criminality and not sufficiently on the patient. And I say patient because of the addict personality. So I've become more and more aware that one realizes that the people in the treatment court are there because they have a real desire to help, to really lead people to hope and success. One needs to see these people for not who they are now, but who they can be, and the treatment court staff do that. It's become my conclusion after watching probation officers working with these clients, collaboratively with the treatment court staff, that these are probably the only real positive people in their lives. And when these two staffs work in conjunction with each other, and they may be instrumental, as it's been mentioned, I think, before, to reunite families, to have custody restored, to have a constant and healthy relationship as a parent to a child. The way I try to introduce treatment court to my staff is to have them go to a graduation. And I've witnessed a number of these treatment court graduations. Many of these, I end up in tears. I think it's a hormonal thing that's happened. But these are always, for me, they're always the culmination and representation of many months of struggle, many months of personal perseverance against the incredible enemy of addiction. But when it's time to go before the judge at the graduation ceremony, it's always a very unique story that captures the heart and essence of the treatment court. It is the testimony by the participant of the fact that the treatment court case manager never gave up on him or her, that they could count on supportive advice, they could count on guidance, and they could count on accountability. It was the acknowledgement that the treatment team had found value in that individual, that the individual began to look at themselves as having value. It was awakening to their own potential and a testimony to their courage. It was a testimony of a professional relationship that was based on trust, respect, accountability that produced motivational change, and their ability to conquer their addiction. As been mentioned earlier today, it's the first time that anyone in an authority position has given them positive feedback, told them how proud they are of that individual for being sober week after week. The applause they hear from the audience when the participants report to the judge how many weeks they've been sober to the participant must sound deafening and overwhelming. The effectiveness of these graduation ceremonies is the culmination of many weeks of positive affirmations. The participants earn by meeting their treatment program objectives. These provide incentive to keep going, to keep seeking more. The affirmations, as has been mentioned, may be a coin, a bus ticket, a candy, but to me, most importantly, it's the one who gives that affirmation to the client that really makes a difference. It's that person who reaches out to them, who demonstrates to them that they really care about their success.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Sir?
To answer that question of how I try to impart the lessons to my colleagues, it's probably first appropriate to answer how drug court has changed me as a prosecutor a bit. And when Bobby first asked me what the general topic of this panel discussion was, I think my answer was probably a little smug in that I felt I was already an enlightened prosecutor, and it really
they always are.
And it hasn't changed me, but I realize I've reflected a little bit, and that's not the right approach. And I really started to think about all the little ways it's changed me. I think even before drug court, I think Judge Pack said, Joe, I love getting you in drug cases. You have a real heart, but I hate getting you in environmental cases. And I think you called me a male part of the anatomy or something, but you don't say those things anymore as a judge. But you know, I tried to be progressive as a drug prosecutor before drug court. And I'm from Vermont Law School, so I am I'm hardcore on environmental violations. So, but drug court, you know, prior to drug court, you would interact with the lower level addict dealers you're prosecuting. If they're cooperating, you'd have proffer interviews once or twice if they're not telling the truth. Your client, sorry, always told the truth the first time, right? And maybe you put them in grand jury and you get little snapshots of their life, and that's it. But with drug court, you're staying with these folks for a year. And as the other panelists and folks have mentioned, you're seeing all these incremental changes and positive changes, and you see how happy someone is just to get their driver's license. I mean, right. You're in your late 20s and they're in tears with happiness because they're getting their driver's license, or a job as a line cook at a chain store, and they're so happy, and it's very satisfying to see that. And, you know, pre-drug court, once in a while a defendant would thank me for being fair, and I'm thinking to my, or giving them a wake up call and helping them get clean because they went to jail for a few months and then got into rehab. And I'm thinking to myself, well, that's great. But now you're in your 20s and you have a felony conviction and it's going to be really hard to get a job. But I think you can do it, but you realize that that's not enough. I mean, that they're going to need more. Drug court gives an opportunity in some cases in our court to get a felony dismissal. But to see those changes, and some folks have real, Matt was talking about the science of addiction, and that's one thing I tried to immerse myself in when I got into drug court, to see the actual physiological mm-hmm. changes in the brain when you look at these MRIs, and you realize it's not just about willpower. I I think, Clay, you mentioned one of the early drug court meetings, and I think I brought up willpower, and Clay said, try willpower on diarrhea. And, you know, it's not a perfect analogy, but, but you know, it got you sensitive to that issue. And there's people that, there's someone I hope will get into drug court soon, that she's early 20s, third generation addict. And you know, what frickin' chance do you have in life growing up under those circumstances? So a lot of this, I encourage my colleagues to come to drug court, try to keep them apprised if they're defendants that they're prosecuting of how well they're doing. The bottom line is it has been a incredibly satisfying part of my career, and I'm very appreciative of the opportunity to work with the drug court team, some of which are in the room.
Awesome. I want to impart two things, and then I'm going to pass it over to Bobby for questions. One thing is that if you are planning a drug court, NADCP has opened up their application process for new drug courts. So get with your coordinator and your judge, and you can submit an application to attend. And they cover the cost for the team members to attend that training. And they're selected on a competitive basis based on what you have in place within your jurisdiction. Number two is evaluation. We have emailed Bobby a link to an evaluation on how I did. I don't carry my feelings on my shoulders because I'm a cop, and that's, we just don't do that. But we want you to honestly answer that, to tell us what was good and what was bad and what you would change about the delivery of the message and the presenter as far as that's concerned. Thank you all. I apologize for having to go, but I've been gone since last Tuesday, and I'd like to get back home on that last flight out today. So I encourage you to continue the work. If you need something from NADCP, Bobby knows how to get a hold of us, and we will do all that we can. And I wish you all well in your further endeavors in drug court. So thank you very much.
One second. Hello, everyone.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
So, panelists, all the judges and justices have left the room. So my question is, we talk a lot about participant change. I'm curious if you have seen any changes in your presiding judges as they get more comfortable in drug court. And that may be more geared toward the attorneys, though not necessarily.
Can I ask a clarifying question?
Yes.
Do you mean in the treatment court itself or across the dockets?
Have at it.
Okay. Well, so I would say yes, but I've been very lucky to have worked with Judge Crawford and Judge Grierson and Judge Crescetti now, who I think already were very compassionate and understanding people to begin with, which is why they were in treatment court. But I want to point out that I actually in the past 10 years have noticed that kind of the culture and understanding of what it is that we're doing in drug court has permeated our court in general. And I think that's been something that I've noticed over the past 10 years. And
can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. Rather than, you know, you're talking about somebody either has a mental illness or an addiction being sort of the underlying root of why something occurred, it's not just an excuse. Oh, you're just making excuses. It's, oh, you've identified an issue. Let's work on that. So I've been able to offer sometimes creative solutions in addressing issues that at first kind of I was looked at like I had two heads, and now it's kind of like, oh yeah, that makes sense. That's how we address things. We identify a problem and we try to get help for folks. So
any other thoughts?
Well, mine's kind of interesting because our judge, Judge McCaffrey, I was his court officer 20 years ago. And that must be really embarrassing for a lot of people here, because I'm probably the youngest person in this room. But that being said, even then, at the district court level, you know, taking it all in, you know, when I got out of the service, it was that very human side, even under the rules of criminal procedure and all that stuff that judges and lawyers do. So I think it goes back to even what we said about law enforcement on the team, having the right judge on the team is extremely important, and I'm glad you guys actually have that evaluation process.
Other thoughts?
Yeah, I wouldn't change a thing. I think that Judge McCaffrey is probably the most humane, compassionate person in general that I've met. And his strength, it really, that I've perceived, is he lets the team come to conclusions. He doesn't try to lead the discussion in any way or be overbearing. But the quality of that court really is dependent upon when the participant goes before the judge on even the weeklies, the types of questions that he asks, the probing questions that he asks, and the responses he gains from the participant really, really enlighten everybody in the room. And I think you talked about the effect of on other participants that are there. I think it really, really causes them to think and to reflect and most of all to be inspired to reach the same level of success and to conquer that addiction. So that there's nothing that I don't think anybody on the team would want to change with our judge. We're so grateful for him.
I think Judge Crawford has been a steady rudder of compassion and understanding and throughout. I think the whole federal judiciary, if whether someone's in drug court or not, we're all trying, and the defense attorney, probation, and prosecutors for these low-level addict dealers, just trying to find a path to recovery. And we have pre-sentence, pre-judgment drug court in Rutland. We have reentry court in Burlington, which is post-sentence, oftentimes post-incarceration. And so I think everybody, prosecutors, defense attorneys, probation officers, federal judges, we're all trying to figure out the best kind of rehab regime. And it, you know, it's frustrating, as I'm sure you all feel at times, that there is, you have to expect relapses and oftentimes multiple stints at rehab. But I think it's important for, and I think our judges and everyone involved recognize that you need to be open-minded, whether someone needs a second or third time at rehab, and we try to accomplish that.
So this may be a little awkward if your colleagues are here, but I'm wondering if your perspective on individuals with whom ordinarily you are in an adversarial relationship has changed in any capacity as a result of participating on a team. Uh-oh. I can't let the laugh go unresponded to. Sarah, do you want to take a shot at that?
I hope that I've become a lot more cooperative with the prosecutor. I'm getting nods, so.
All right. But so the witness is directed to answer the question, which is, has your attitude toward people who you were previously in an adversary relationship shifted at all?
Yes, it has. I think I've, to the extent that I can, have tried to take the collaborative process much, much further. Then there are cases that have to be litigated. I think that there's a lot less emotion when that needs to happen. And I've been able to collaborate a lot more with prosecutors. I mentioned before following them around and telling them about my clients, and I wasn't kidding. I do that. And so it's, you know, just I think it, overall it's become a lot more collaborative.
Keith, are you part of the team that will do staffing prior to the court hearings?
When I can attend, yes. I'm also on the judicial subcommittee. So I would say that with our defense, who many of our people in the room know, with Steve, he's the kind of person that can drive you crazy. But always what I've come to learn, just because the conversations go on, and he many times when I first hear the proposal, it's not conceivable that I would agree to it or we would agree to it. But if I'm patient and I listen to Steve long enough, then I come to a realization, obviously, that he cares completely about his clients, 100% commitment to his clients. And over the years, I think that he's kind of been more pliable in terms of coming to conclusions that we would favor. But we've never had a real disagreement. But the way that he develops a relationship with his clients is very evident, that he's always representing them in the best interest. And his boss is a little hard to deal with sometimes in terms of what can we get for an agreement, how quickly can we get this person into to drug court. But it's a wonderful office on the defense side, and we have great collaboration. Not too many disagreements.
Words not often heard spoken by a probation officer or supervisor. Thank you. Mr. Perella, and then Matt.
Yes, Natasha Sen is the primary defense attorney on drug court, and Beth Mann is the sub. And I think all of us, we try to take off the prosecution hat, take off the defense hat, listen to one another, and what we're really trying to do is what is best for this person's recovery and what is best for the success of the overall drug court. And I think we do a good job of discussing that. It's the answers aren't always obvious, but we're at least trying to come up with an answer that serves those two interests without carrying our traditional hat with us.
Great. Matt?
So the relationship inside the drug court as compared to down the hall in the criminal court are probably very different. That being said, on the team, I really appreciate Steve. I know, well, it's been, 2 years now, Steve? A little over that? And it's really, I want them to know what we know, and I think we all have the same goal from the street. And I think it may have been a hard sell for the defense to know that the city police are now trying to build a case on the individual in treatment court, because it is counterintuitive for us. First off, we probably already know the information that we're sharing and staffing anyway. But probably more importantly is that it's in our interest as the face of government that focus in neighborhoods that these folks get well. And when you rate your police department on outcomes that aren't based on counting widgets like arrests and tickets, and your outcomes are based on do you feel safe on a street, or you know, the quality of life things, like that's what we're trying to measure now, it's a very different way of going about your business. And I think that's been very helpful in these conversations in the treatment court with the defense. And, you know, sometimes we're actually at odds with prosecution on whether or not someone should come into treatment court, which is why I try to step back a little bit on those. But, you know, if you have someone who wants to go through for the fifth time, maybe I'll step up. No, I don't think that's a good idea. They have the tools. But outside of that, I think I've been really impressed with the with us to have real conversation and not just people walking away and saying, you know, I'm done with you. And, you know, we have enough respect for each other to accomplish that.
Bobby, can I add one thing?
Yes.
This Monday, we're actually going to vote on adding a probation officer full-time to the team, and also a police officer full-time to the team. So we're very excited about that opportunity.
Matt, I think you touched on an extraordinarily important point, which is a redefinition of what it means to be successful as a police officer, as a prosecutor, as a defense attorney. I'm going to absolutely not editorialize, but I noticed that T.J. Donovan is here, and perhaps more than anyone, from the prosecution perspective, he has helped redefine what it means to be successful. And outcomes are extraordinarily important, not pounds of flesh. So what are we missing in our regular dockets that we could be doing now without, well, I'll leave it at that. What are we missing in the regular dockets?
Basic respect for the people who come before the court.
Sorry. Thank you.
Say that again, please.
That's a nice way to say it. You did a great job.
I said basic respect for the people that come before the court. They are human beings, and they didn't get there because they necessarily chose the life that they were born into. Addiction is not a choice. It's a disease.
Thoughts? Yeah, I agree. Treating defendants as people with lives. And one thing, one very satisfying thing in drug court, when we have little pizza parties or for New Year's and all sitting around a table, if you didn't know this person's criminal history, you would have no idea that they were slinging large quantities of heroin to support their addiction. And now they're at this little court get together with their kids and working and seeing them as people, and reducing the stigma of addiction is so important to their recovery.
I would just add that if we could not look at the past as much as we do and look at the potential a lot more, I think that we'd be much better served, and to take a look at all the circumstances that are affecting that case in a more expedient way than we do.
Are you folks willing to turn this over to the masses out there?
Sure.
Does anyone have any questions? And if so, please raise your hand, and Matt will walk around with a microphone. Somebody ask a question, please. There's a hand. Thank you, Sam.
It isn't so much a question as I'm going to tell a story on Joe Perella that I thought epitomized the changes in the role. One of our drug court graduates, young woman, had, apart from her criminal and addiction problems, which were our problems, had a terrible family problem. Her daughter lived with her mother, and it was a long history, I'm sure, of burned bridges. The mother and the daughter weren't speaking to each other, and our participant never saw the child. And we were all aware, you know, it's a crippling injury and a terrible problem, but it wasn't really kind of in front of us. So Joe, without telling anybody, got in the car, picked up an FBI agent as muscle and a witness, and drove to the mom's house and sat down and explained how well the daughter was doing in drug court, shook hands, and left. And it didn't work a miracle, but it worked a change. And mother and daughter speaking now, and our participant, our graduate, is seeing her child. And I thought, now that's really stepping out of the role and in a very creative, positive way, you know, taking on a different kind of responsibility. And for me, that really sort of exemplifies the role change that happens in the drug court setting.
Nice. Thank you, Judge.
Thanks.
Sam.
I was curious if the panelists could talk about not the discussions they have about drug court with the people in their immediate offices, but with the people in the same jobs in parts of the state that don't have drug courts, if any of them have discussions with those folks and how those go.
Well, if I was part of that discussion, I would encourage any new drug court to not be completely top-down approach. What I mean is not just the judge and the clerk and some folks from treatment. You need to have police and probation and parole involved, because to take Vanessa's saying, you don't know what you don't know. And this whole by appointment way of doing business that has permeated a lot of our disciplines, whether it be in the mental health community and in treatment and things like that. At least in Rutland County, we're really trying to get away from that. And it's part of our community collaborative with Project Vision is how do we take services, you know, out on the street and meet people where they're at. Well, part of treatment court and getting information and when that, those officers, whether it be myself or Sergeant Sheldon or others, are out and about on our particular beats and we see people where they shouldn't be that hold people in places, et cetera, where the alarms are going off, the quicker I can get that information to Jess and at the time Alan or whoever, there could be an intervention. Because regardless of whether or not somebody graduates from treatment court, I mean, that's what you want, but that time spent in treatment court is not time ill spent, whether they end up getting discharged or not. There was a big block of time where someone was relatively safe, their life was kind of normal, things were different. And it may take the second time around, it may take another couple of major charges or something like that for them to get to the point where they're ready to really engage in recovery. But hopefully that block of time where they were treated well, people were really invested in their lives, will be something that will go, you know what, that wasn't so bad, and go back to that. So that would be my advice to anyone forming a treatment court.
I changed the question around a little bit and just talk about my own experience. I think it's important that the treatment courts really reach out to people. Karen Gannett, who received the award today, really deserving person for that award. She actually reached out to me when I came into the office in Rutland as district manager, so, and then encouraged me to go to training. And so it was a repetition of seeing and hearing and observing that really made a difference in my personal thinking. And I think that's important if we're going to take it statewide. I think that people really have to, as much as, you know, we hate to do this sometimes, make personal invitations to come to court or to come to a staffing or to meet the treatment team. So invite them to training, sponsor their training.
In the federal system, we only have pre-judgment court, drug court in the Rutland area. So arguably there's some inequities, not arguably, most people would say there are some inequities in people in other parts of the state that don't have that opportunity. And yet, you know, hopefully drug court, federal drug court successful, it does spread, but still as a practical matter, you're probably not going to be able to have a drug court in every region because the drug court needs to be connected to the rehab services in close by. But I think there are ways to try to move toward equalization by being maybe postponing sentencing. Like in federal drug court in Rutland, the person changes their plea and then goes into drug court. And then drug court, how you do in drug court's the only thing standing between you and sentencing. But there, and I think we, the federal judiciary and prosecutors and defense attorneys, and generally try to do this in non-drug court areas. If there's a long-term rehab available to postpone sentencing, so you have more of a track record to inform the court when sentencing comes around. And there's often one of the things I've learned is someone is well into their recovery, there is a very strong argument it does not make sense to yank them out of that recovery and put them in jail. Oftentimes, though, at the front end of the recovery, and defendants will say this, 2 or 3 months in jail helped them enormously. So there's that difference. And then with people where there's, where you're not in drug court, where you're in a region with not in drug court, I know I've changed my view of pre-sentence release violations where maybe my pre-drug court days, if there someone was on pre-sentence, pre-trial release, and they violated, I would be pounding the table and saying, Your Honor, they had their chance, they messed up, and there needs to be consequences. And I think drug court teaches you that oftentimes it's two steps forward but one step back, and be a little more tolerant of that. And that does not mean the person is going to fail in recovery.
There's a difference between tolerance and permissiveness, and you can be tolerant without being permissive. I'm not going to force questions on the group. Up there in the back.
One of the struggles that I have with treatment court is the ever-changing nature of it and the lack of clear, unchanging rules. In terms of expectations and what the outcome will be and what the benefit will be, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm just curious if the panelists have ideas about statutory fixes to that or rules committee fixes to that.
I have an answer. I do think, I guess I'm not one of the panelists, but echoing what Patricia Gable said earlier, with the Supreme Court's move toward consistency and insisting on best practices, I think we will find greater uniformity moving forward in how programs are run. One of the challenges is that we have some programs that are pre-conviction, we have some that are post-conviction pre-sentence, and we have some that are post-conviction post-sentence, and I think in some instances we have some reentry folks as well. So we have multiple models already that potentially lends to some of that disparity in response. So I think if we follow consistently best practices, some of that will dissipate. I don't know if anyone else wanted to comment on that.
Well, I think that the way that the courts have grown, they've been very localized. And I know that there are some concerns about losing some of the uniqueness of each of the courts. So I guess this is something, just a comment that I would like to make, that, you know, when those decisions are being made, that those of us who have been on the ground for a very long time would like to be invited to the table to talk about it.
Excellent comment. I think with that, I'd like to thank all of you, Matt, Sarah, Keith, and Joe, for your presentation. Thank you very much.